Welcome to High Truths on Drugs and Addiction, where national experts bring you facts and answers. I'm your host, Dr. Onit Lev, an emergency and addiction doctor who has served at the White House and practiced on the front lines. Right here on High Truths, you will learn from experts from around the globe and around all aspects of drugs and addiction. High Truths is more than a podcast. It's a movement to unite physical, mental, and addiction health. It brings innovations to connect public health, public safety, and prevention. Our discussions inspire people to implement programs that save lives. To grow this community of information and action, I hope you give us a 5-star review. Come visit me on hightruths.com. Today's episode is sponsored by Drug Free America Foundation, tackling the pervasive issue of substance use and its far-reaching impacts on individuals, families, and community. Drug Free America is supporting ISAC, the International Academy on the Science and Impact of Cannabis, doctors and scientists educating on the harms of marijuana. Hello again, High Truth listeners. Get ready for a prevention conversation. I'm your host, Dr. Onit Lev. Prevention, as in preventing a problem before it starts. One of my favorite doctors is Dr. Benjamin Franklin. He is famous for many things, including the statement, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. He's not talking about diabetes or high blood pressure. Investing in preventing disease rather than a major focus on treatment is a type of disease prevention that RFK Jr. is promoting as Assistant Secretary of Health and Human Services. Dr. Benjamin Franklin was talking about preventing fire safety. He supported treating fires using the Bucket Brigade, an efficient method of pouring water on fires. But he made sure Philadelphia invested in fire prevention, such as various chimney safety measures that were traced as the cause of many fires. I like to learn from history and how we greatly decreased tobacco use. We made tobacco uncool, and we went down from 45% of the population using in 1963 to 11% today. Wonderful strides. I learned from the opiate prescription epidemic, we implemented safe prescribing and decreased the supply of opioids, ending the opiate prescription epidemic. Results occurred with upstream policies, tackling supply and prevention. There's a common saying you may have heard, the war on drugs failed. It's a catchy phrase, but it should not imply that we should now openly allow drug use and dealing. That policy also failed, as we've seen in California, Oregon, and Washington. There's another saying of, we won't arrest our way out of the problem. Well, it depends who we arrest. Upstream deterrence is important. Arresting downstream low-level dealing, I agree, won't solve the issue. But drug deterrence is very important in the overall solution of drugs. I can tell you that history teaches us that we will not naloxone our way out of addiction. We won't suboxone our way out of addiction. Those are life-saving measures that are important, but they're downstream. They won't stop the bleed. To end this crisis, we need strong deterrence in the supply of drugs and increased primary prevention to teach young Americans how to deal with life's adversities and stresses in healthy ways that avoid drugs. It's time to return to investing in prevention. And to learn more about prevention, I reached out to Dr. Laura Papard. Dr. Laura Papard is a psychiatric nurse practitioner and director of ADAPT, a National Training and Technical Assistance Division for Substance Use Prevention for HIDA, High Intensity Drug Trafficking Area. The program is run by my prior federal department that I worked for, the White House Office of National Drug Control Policy. She also served as the immediate past president of the American Psychiatric Nurse Association. She's on the advisory board for SAMHSA's Prevention Technology and Transfer Center Network Coordinating Office. To learn more about Dr. Laura Papard and the ADAPT Prevention Program, check out the High Truth show notes. Dr. Laura Papard, welcome to High Truths.
Thank you. It's so nice to be here.
I'm very excited to have you. I've heard you speak and we interacted together and you know, many people teach me things, but one of the things and what you've taught me about prevention science has stayed with me a long time. And that's why I'm so excited to have my audience share in your knowledge and expertise. Let's start. You are a nurse practitioner who is now a national prevention expert. How did that happen?
Wow. You know, it just happened, but I'll tell you, I think it's because I allowed it to happen. I really have felt strongly about going where I'm needed and kind of being open to new opportunities. But I did. I started out as a psychiatric nurse practitioner. I even up until a few months ago was still trying to see patients, college students, one evening a week. But I did that for about 21 years. And this opportunity just kind of came its way. I think when I was at the university, so I practiced clinically for several years and then decided, well, maybe I'd like to mentor and train students, right, on how to approach integrating various evidence-based strategies into practice. And so I went into the university and began teaching, developed the Doctor of Nursing Practice program for one of the universities and the psychiatric nurse practitioner track, and really loved it. But it was there that I was able to start working on grants and writing proposals for federal funding and really start to apply some systems thinking. You know, how can we help communities advance some of these, at the time, what were integrated care models? So bringing behavioral health and substance use strategies into the clinics where traditionally medicine was delivered, and they weren't necessarily thinking about the whole body yet. So that was, I think, where I first started dabbling in, well, maybe I could do something unconventional, right, related to this more traditional clinical practice track. And we did it, and we were successful with it. With a variety of different integrated care models. And I was on a panel, sitting on a panel, a criminal justice one, actually, with Tom Carr, who was the executive director of Washington Baltimore HIDA. And we ended up presenting things together. And when I walked off stage, having just presented outcomes from a few of our grants, he said, "You know what, Laura, you have presented this vision for kind of where you'd like to see things head. I think I can help you with that." And the rest is really history. You know, he started educating me on what HIDA was, and we talked about some of the opportunities, a lot of the needs, and the strengths of law enforcement, and a lot of the work that HIDA was doing. And
so wait, tell us, since we've mentioned HIDA, I don't know if all my audience knows what HIDA is, but interestingly, HIDA is what got me connected on a larger scale as well. But tell our audience, what is HIDA?
Sure. HIDA stands for High Intensity Drug Trafficking Area. It's a grant-funded program out of the Office of National Drug Control Policy. You may be familiar with another grant-funded program called the Drug-Free Communities Grant, out of that same office. And the mission of HIDA is to disrupt and dismantle drug trafficking organizations and money laundering organizations. So they really are focused on supply reduction and limiting that access, right? Which we know is a very important strategy for reducing substance use in our nation. Interestingly, though, a small portion of their budget does go towards prevention. And they take that small investment very seriously and see it as very complementary. So reducing the demand for substances is also important to them as this complementary intervention. So HIDA, over the last 5 years, has really tried to operationalize their first HIDA prevention strategy. And I'll pause there, but that's what HIDA is and kind of how prevention has come to be. They've been operating in prevention for a while, but the first HIDA prevention strategy was established in 2019. I think you were there. Yes. We met you at the office when we all came together.
That's right. I was very excited. It's interesting, we have that in common. I remember, like, I was looking for someone to print our safe prescribing guidelines. And so I was looking for money, and I got it from law enforcement. Like, why would law enforcement want to give money to doctors? But again, we had the same ultimate goal. And that started my relationship with Haida many years ago. But so now you're working, you went from clinical work, which you said you do here and there, to working with government. What is that like?
The impact feels different. So as you know, right, sitting one-on-one with a patient is special in its own way, right? You feel the individual transforming in ways that make sense for them, and you support them in that journey. Working with the government is different in that, you know, you're able to apply a systems lens. You're able to influence approaches and educate towards policies and best practices, and you're able to experience what's happening boots on the ground, but also help advance ways of thinking about it and connect the right people and the right organizations and the right partners. So I've really enjoyed it. You know, I've had to very intentionally remind myself that systems level impact, systems level change, you know, doesn't occur overnight. Whereas with a patient, you know, you feel like you have a little more control, right, over that experience with them, right, and what you're able to deliver and offer them. In this line of work now, we're really relying on everyone that we have a touch point with to go forth and do wonderful things, right, to help advance, help with this ripple effect of sorts, right, help to carry forward these ways of thinking, the best available evidence in ways that make sense for all of them. So translating that evidence is very different on a systems level than it is on an individual level.
Yeah, you have a greater, wider outreach. So your expertise is in prevention. Tell us, what does that mean, prevention? Because I see that word tossed around to mean different things. And I know that there are some definitions, primary, secondary, tertiary prevention. What is prevention?
Yeah. Well, I'd love to start with one of our really strong partners in the work that we do is the National Prevention Science Coalition. And so when we think about prevention, and maybe some of the viewers are familiar and maybe some are not with the Institute of Medicine's continuum of care, right? And you see this spot within that visual that is dedicated towards prevention in three domains, right? Universal prevention, so preventing onset, right? Or somewhat escalation of use, and you've got selected and indicated components, all requiring different types of strategies. But we like to kind of lean into the definition of prevention science because we think it really brings the why to life, right? It starts to characterize and describe what we're doing in the field of prevention. And so I'd love to just read to you the definition that the National Prevention Science Coalition uses, because it's one that's been adopted by several organizations, many of them reputable, some of them federal, right, in describing prevention science and what we're ultimately aiming to bring forward. Their definition is the study of determinants, so the determinants of individual, family, community, and societal level problems, with the goal to develop science-based prevention practices, interventions, and policies that reduce the incidence of harmful conditions and promote the processes and conditions that enhance health and safety. And so inherent in that, you see this reduction of risk, promotion of protection. And that really seems to bring to life this big picture of what prevention is. Prevention is not just preventing a condition. It really is intentionally creating these environments for well-being.
And it applies to substance use disorder, which is what you're working on, but it would apply to diabetes and high blood pressure and cancers and other conditions as well.
Everything. Yep.
Yeah. So when we talk about people say, well, naloxone is prevention, is that a type of prevention? Is that tertiary prevention?
Sure. Yeah. So that is preventing, it's mitigating further harm. It's preventing further harm, right? So you're alluding to primary, secondary, and tertiary. And that is one way of thinking about it, one model, right, that has been promoted and still used. And CDC and SAMHSA have a beautiful way of kind of blending these primary, secondary, tertiary ways of speaking about it with the universal, selective, and indicated ways of speaking about it. They have a nice marriage of that. But primary prevention is really preventing the onset of symptoms, right? The onset of conditions. And then secondary intervention is addressing more of those risky, those early stages of, in this case, use, substance use, but trying to prevent further escalation of that. And then tertiary is preventing further harm. So once a disease or disorder has been established, right, preventing further harm from that. And that's where naloxone falls as a strategy. But it's also very important to note that it's a strategy for a particular outcome of overdose, right?
So yeah. And I'm wondering, as you're saying that, if naloxone doesn't even fit that definition perfectly, it's really a rescue life-saving drug, because people who die don't always have a substance use disorder. They may have taken something by mistake, but it just saves their life.
Yeah. So we've been careful to try to just make sure that language is clear and what we promote, that, you know, there are overdose prevention strategies. And it's important to note that they are focused on that singular outcome, right? Mm-hmm. As opposed to the behavior of use itself.
So I've seen some grants where people are supposed to be doing prevention, but it's given to harm reduction. Is that different? I always think about harm reduction is for people who have a use disorder. They're not willing to go to treatment, so at least we are keeping them alive with harm reduction methods. But I see that definition of what harm reduction is and prevention is gets confused. What do you think?
Sure. Yeah, I think it does, because people are trying to respond. You know, not everyone. People have very clear goals in mind of what they're trying to achieve. And the funding streams, you know, in this case, it's timely. Overdose is a concern with the use of opioids across the nation and the outcomes of that. So they are leveraging, you know, the funding streams to identify and also implement and operationalize various strategies in the community. But, you know, that said, harm reduction is a very specific way of thinking about prevention. We just talked about, you know, there are different outcomes that you look for in prevention. If you're looking for preventing onset of use at all, and you're really targeting that youth population, right, harm reduction will be one piece, right, of the overall strategy. And oftentimes we'll use harm reduction as, you know, the point of interest that people are coming to us with, asking questions and, you know, submitting requests for technical assistance related to that. We'll use that to lead into a conversation about the bigger picture. You know, what are you really trying to achieve? And if you spend enough time with a lot of folks, they will tell you that overdose is definitely forefront on our minds right now, because we don't want one more death, right? But absolutely, we do want to achieve in our youth, no use, right? And we want to prevent the escalation of use. So that comprehensive prevention strategy and infrastructure is important to most communities. And sometimes harm reduction is just the gateway into that conversation, fully recognizing that it's important and it needs to be part of the overall strategy.
Yeah. You know, when I was working on the opioid prescription problem, the first thing I did is cut the chart of where the supply is coming to. So if it's coming from pharmaceutical medical community, for me, that we define that data and that goal to reduce it. But also I was seeing two different populations. I saw people who came in with a bucket of medications, and I'm like, I just have to keep you alive somehow feel like maybe that's the harm reduction definition. We didn't have that definition in those days as much. And then I saw the other people who like have a toothache and they're getting 30 Percocets. And then it's like, we need to create an American, next generation of American who don't have an addiction to opioids. And I think, you know, having the different definitions, I think now that you're saying it is clarifies it more for me, where you could have universal prevention. I think that is what we're missing a lot in this country, and which is primary prevention. And we're doing a lot in selective measures or secondary, tertiary prevention.
One of those indicators, yeah, specific to that outcome. And, you know, we see it as an opportunity. You know, it's an opportunity because people are interested in doing something about that challenge, right? They are also amenable to, like I said, opening up their minds towards what else is happening in terms of how are we preventing use in the first place, you know, and that automatically leads us to a discussion about the youth. And then that leads us to schools, what's happening in the schools, what's happening in the home, right? What's happening at the healthcare facilities, these primary environments where we have these huge opportunities, who are the trusted adults and relationships in their lives. And it really opens up this big wide world of intervention for laying these, creating these protective environments, right? And it's interesting that we're talking about this now because 2025 is going to be a year that ADAPT starts really building into that a lot of resources. And so you'll see more come out. Hopefully you'll be equally as excited about them.
I will be.
Right? More coming out about that.
So let me, is that a goal? And I don't know if you'll be telling me, but, you know, having the goal, that was my goal with opioid prescription, but now thinking broader for all substances, of creating a resilient next generation of Americans, youth who deal with life stresses in other ways rather than going to drugs. Is that a possible goal? That would be my goal.
100%. That's, you know, everyone's goal, if you sit with them long enough, does seem to be youth well-being. And we haven't encountered one person who doesn't want the absolute best, right? For the youth of our nation. So, and I use that word well-being intentionally, but you see it interchanged with flourishing. They want to see youth flourish. They want to see youth thrive. And this comes from, you know, Christine Bethel's, a lot of her science and research. She leads the Child and Adolescent Health Measurement Initiative at Johns Hopkins. She was our keynote at our summit in October, and she spoke about youth flourishing. And she spoke about how we are the medicine and kind of this positivity paradox, you know, that we have this opportunity before us and it's more than just understanding the science. It's bringing that science to life. And that's what we want to work on and focus on in 2025 is more tools, right? More focus on the relationship piece. One really compelling thing she mentioned that has just stuck with me was that there are six things that are six attributes that are relationally learned related to flourishing and setting youth up for success in that domain. And they can only be, one of them is sense of meaning. You know, youth need relationships to really develop a strong sense of meaning for things that are experiences that are happening in their lives. They need connectedness, you know, with adults and all of these really important processes and developmental pieces happen and protective developmental pieces, right? Happen when in the context of these really positive and strong relationships. So, yeah, I think no one would deny the fact that we want to see confident, you know, good decision-making youth in.
So we agree on the goals. And let me ask you, what about the effectiveness of these prevention programs? Does prevention work? We all hear about, oh, the DARE program didn't work. And so they scrapped everything. They threw out the baby and the bathwater and people stopped doing prevention. But is there effectiveness and science behind this prevention. Maybe share some of that.
Yeah, there without a doubt is a large evidence base for substance use prevention. And one of the ways that you can discover that evidence is through databases like Blueprints for Healthy Youth Development. You can type in keywords. If you just went on there and you typed in youth substance use prevention, right? You would see a variety of different types of prevention strategies that come up. They have been looked at and the science, the studies have been appraised, and they're graded or rated on a scale where in this particular database, the highest level, you know, you've got a lot of rigorous studies that have been applied, many of them randomized controlled trials, but that would be called like a model plus. And then you've got model, you know, very good, right? You can rely on this, right? Still may require some adaptations, right, that need to be thoughtful and make sure that they still maintain fidelity to the intervention. But model, then you go to promising, still good. You know, that's a good base that we can draw from. And then emerging. So all of it is valuable. And the best available evidence, this phrase, is very important because, you know, there are things like we're talking about overdoses. There are outcomes. There are other behaviors where, you know, we're still looking. We're still developing an evidence base for that. You know, that base might be emerging still. We're still looking to see and follow youth, you know, if they are trained on naloxone, right? What happens with that behavior? Do they use it, right, when they need to? Like, we're building that evidence base actively as we speak right now, which is wonderful. But there are strategies that work. And one of the biggest things that we have noticed as a training and technical assistance provider across the nation is that many people are not evaluating what they're doing to determine if it does work, right? Many communities are implementing things that do, they feel really good, they seem right, they seem like they might be effective, but they don't know for sure. And they are not as familiar with what we do know works in terms of core components, programs, policies, practices. So a large part of our job is to train and educate on what some of the evidence is, the science is. But we have a large science base out there of what works. We just need to get it out into communities.
And what you mean works means there's a program that's been studied, and this, you know, group of population received the program. This similar group did not receive the program, and the group that received the program didn't start using drugs, have better academic achievement, have less violence, less bullying, things like that, that they've seen long term that by doing this program, it works. And that's what evidence-based and science means. Am I saying that right?
Yeah. So when we talk about effective programs and what works, we are specifically speaking to an outcome that we are looking for. So it has been studied for that outcome. So substance use prevention, you might have outcomes like preventing onset of use. So you're looking at how many eventually do or do not start using, right? Mm-hmm. You might be looking at reducing use. So you're looking at the numbers reporting use of a certain substance or more. So,
or delaying use, waiting till you're 25.
Or delaying use. Yep. And that, yes, that would be in that initiation or onset category, right? Like how, at what age of first use? And you see a lot of state data sets that will capture this in their state surveys with the schools and the youth and ask them specifically, you know, when they started using. Or, yeah, they ask them that specific question. I was just reviewing that the other day for a presentation, looking at the types, the way that they're framing the questions, but at the age of first use. And so it's important to note that when we say what works, it's not what feels good. It's what has been demonstrated to have an effect that you want on that outcome you're looking for. So
isn't it hard to do? Because it takes time. Like, right, if I want no onset of use and I'm doing this program for, you know, 10 and 12 year olds, then I have to wait till they're 25. That's like, you know, another 15 years to see that that really worked.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, it requires commitment. It does require hard work, and it requires a dedication to evaluation and the study of it. But going back to, we have an evidence base already that you can lean on, right, in terms of determining what strategy might be a good first pick or a good next pick if something isn't working for you. And I think stressing the importance of whatever you do, evaluate it, right?
Is that expensive?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're asking some really great questions. It is expensive sometimes.
Because you meet people, I'm sure you've met people who go around and they seem to have great results and they do a lot of educating, but they don't have that certification that, you know, that they're evidence-based. But yet you want to help them because they seem to be doing good. Do they need to wait 10 years and spend all that money to show what they're doing is good? Doesn't that? I'm wondering if there's a way to help those kind of people who, you know.
We always encourage to reach out to universities, academic partners, right? There are a lot of academic partners that are hungry to serve in this way, hungry to partner with community-based organizations, right? To advance what they're doing and to evaluate what they're doing. So that's a natural kind of starting point. We also have tried to shift mindsets towards building it in to budget line items, building in, you know, if you have to externally source the evaluation, which many have to do if they want to do it right, then honoring kind of this commitment towards evaluating what you're doing and building it into budget line items, seeking additional funding because it's important. So there are a variety of ways to think about how to get the evaluation accomplished. But usually the first step is in helping build the rationale and the logic behind why it's important for the organization and figuring out what outcomes, right? Where does it align with the strategic plan, right, of that organization? Where does it align with the strategic plan for the community and what the community wants? And starting to identify those shared goals and outcomes and how maybe the interventions and the approach is helping to achieve those shared outcomes. Threading together lines of funding is something else we've seen to help support evaluation. So it's real. And you know what, Ronnie, these are the hard conversations that we frequently have, because this is what we need to be talking about, how important evaluation is. We need to be talking about striving towards effective prevention. Like, what is prevention really?
But it seems like there's a lot of scrutiny in doing these programs that I think are the most important things to get a healthier next generation of Americans who have tools and avoid drugs. But, you know, I'll see, an extreme would be boofing kits for harm reduction. And I don't know, where's the evidence on that? Or other very, you know, social justice and other ideas out there for drug use that's not evidence-based, but it's still promoted, but such scrutiny on prevention programs.
Yeah.
I don't know if you feel that imbalance. It seems like off balance to me.
We have several communities that feel very strongly that what they're doing is important and it's working. And to that extent, we always honor, you know, we try to, the first step with them is always to identify, okay, what within what you're doing, if you break that down, are there core components to what we know has been demonstrated to work, right? So reconciling it with the current evidence base to see if there are pieces, right, that are already established in the evidence. But then beyond that, it's really working with them. There are cultural nuances, right? There are communities that really won't respond to maybe some of the strategies that just haven't been studied in their particular population or their particular culture. So there is a certain respect for, you know, if you're doing something you feel very strongly about, honoring that, but also that's where this, just make sure you're evaluating it because you want to make sure it's getting you to where you want to go. One of our consultants always asks this question. He's like, what is the opportunity cost? If you're spending time and resources, whether they're financial, their personnel, whatever it might be, if you're investing in it in some way, what's the opportunity cost? What else could you be investing in that we know has an evidence base that you can try? And so that's always just a very important question to consider. And so for these, for the new strategies that are out there and being promoted, we always try to learn about what's driving that. You know, why would you choose a new strategy over one that's established? And inevitably, there usually is a logic. So we just encourage them to evaluate it. But yeah, they're popping out from everywhere, right? You see a ton of new strategies across the prevention continuum.
Right, right. And I guess that's okay, but I'm wondering if you should get federal funding for something that's not evidence-based. But tell me about people who are doing prevention right. Give me some example of some organizations that are doing a good job in prevention.
Well, I mentioned to you our partner, National Prevention Science Coalition, mm-hmm. and another one, Applied Prevention Science International. You know, these are two partners that really just stand on everything they do, right, is grounded and rooted in the science because they want to understand that. And you see them synthesizing various science-based strategies together to address various problems, right? Through a prevention lens. So we are just over the moon that they, you know, spend time with us and like to partner with us on these things. There's a whole host of communities, programs. I'm thinking specifically, are you interested in larger organizations?
Tell me what would you pick as a model?
One community that we've worked a lot with because it's in the Washington-Baltimore-Haida region, so I work with them in my deputy director role for that Haida as well, is the Martinsburg Initiative out in Berkeley County, West Virginia. And this particular initiative has a three-pronged approach to their entire community and substance use and trauma prevention in their community. And so there is an ACEs or adverse childhood events angle to this particular model, but there's a huge substance use prevention focus as well. And what they've done is they've hired a variety of social workers in the schools. They have touch points in the emergency department. They have touch points with the families. And they have a tiered approach where they have universal application of substance use prevention strategies. They have a youth coalition that's been built. They implement a substance use prevention curriculum that is evidence-based in the schools. They actively engage parents in the discussion and work with parents on different parenting strategies in the home for those youth that are at higher risk. And they have mitigation strategies for the third tier, right? Which are those that are, they measure things like child resilience. They measure belongingness. You know, they measure some of the often overlooked variables in youth that might be contributing to why they are behaving the way they're behaving and feeling the way they're feeling. So that particular model has been recognized nationally, I believe, in the Surgeon General's report, and it's one that is promoted and we find extremely positive. The outcomes have also been looked at by the CDC. It's received attention across the board in many different capacities from different communities. And they do have an implementation guide that they have developed, and they do rigorous evaluation and follow that. So I appreciate that about them.
That's great. So we mentioned ADAPT. What is ADAPT and why is it called ADAPT?
Good question. ADAPT is a National Training and Technical Assistance Division. It, interestingly enough, it is funded by the National HIDA program to operationalize that HIDA prevention strategy that we were talking about earlier, and to support developing prevention infrastructures within the HIDAs. There are 33 HIDAs across the nation, so all of them operate a little differently as it relates to prevention. The primary mission of ADAPT is to support integration of the best available evidence into HIDA communities. And 66% of Americans live in a HIDA community. So there's no lack of opportunity for the type of support and assistance we can provide. We tend to provide training and technical assistance across what we call 9 domains. It might be supporting a community in identifying a best practice to implement, in developing a logic model, in providing a training of some sort, in implementing a specific strategy to fidelity, in developing an evaluation plan, in applying substance use prevention communications science to their work, in maybe fleshing out a system strategy for what they'd like to do that addresses individuals, families, schools. So I always say that it starts with a conversation, technical assistance, and then it, more often than not, it leads into very specific goals and we help them achieve those goals. It can last. We talked about an example with San Diego.
Yeah, because you came out and you helped San Diego in a, you know, real, I was so excited that you worked with our district attorney, with our HIDA, with our school system. But I was surprised that it took over a year for people just to agree what program to use.
Well, I think, you know, that was one of the longer and more thoughtful TAs that we have been a part of, because that group was dynamic. And they were very hungry to learn about how to think about the evidence. They went through multiple reviews of the evidence. They bounced it off of what would be usable and acceptable and feasible, right, to the communities that they were working with. And they were very thoughtful and intentional about making sure they explored all angles, that they understood the why, they understood the how they arrived at the decisions, and that they put all of this experience together through language that was clear and concise and messaged that year-long journey, right, to the communities that they were targeting, the school systems that they were trying to support in you know, very clear and concise ways to support them in making a decision towards adopting a substance use prevention curriculum that had an evidence base. So I think it taking a year actually was wonderful, because it represents that they were serious about not just doing something ad hoc, you know, some cookie cutter approach, but instead really trying to figure out what is the best approach for our unique community.
What would it take for every community, and every is a hard word, the majority of communities in America to be incentivized and not just adopt and implement such programs?
There's not one answer for that. I think you've heard the expression, meeting them where they're at. That has been our experience time over time over time again, even to the point where it's very easy. We have, we know what the solutions are, but you can't say, just do it, right? Just do it. Here's a nice, clear picture for you of what you
should do. But that's why I asked you in terms of incentives. What if we, and our, usually incentives are money. Or withholding some other program or something. It could be a carrot or a stick. Are there carrots and sticks that you could think of to encourage communities?
It's interesting that, I think that would be like a second step, the incentives. Mm-hmm. Because think about it. You can give them everything that they need, but if they're not ready to implement it and willing to implement it, they're not going to implement it.
There's some legislative things, and again, I may not speak to the quality of the programs, but I'm thinking in California, the governor signed a law that you will have some fentanyl education in the school if during PE or something, things can be legislated. It doesn't legislate the quality, but it can be. And I think, I don't know if that seems like the vision for San Diego is to have it voluntary, to be a model, and then to have it, to show that it's effective, and then to have it spread to the rest of the state.
That's an extremely strong model. If you can, the higher up you can have the champion, the better. And then if you can have champions across the board at every level that really buy into the rationale behind why it's important, that really buy into the logic, that really can see that bigger picture, but very importantly, can identify the love language, if you will, of those in the community that they need to rally to adopt it and to do the work to join them, right? That's kind of where the rubber meets the road. So you are absolutely correct. And I love how you went there with thinking about policy as an incentive of some sort and a driver, really. We do need policy. If you think through, if every state was to say, not just make sure that fentanyl education is in every single school, right? And check that box, middle and high school, let's say, right? For appropriate levels. But instead, if they were to say, make sure that fentanyl education is integrated into an evidence-based substance use prevention strategy in every school, that means something completely different. Then you wouldn't see maybe a one-hour addition, right, for fentanyl education, which is very important, right, and needed, but you wouldn't see that being implemented in isolation. You would see schools being able to think through a much bigger thought process.
I call it going upstream, right? Just teaching about fentanyl is very downstream.
What else am I doing?
Okay, like go upstream and teach those kind of things. That's great. You mentioned before, and I want to, I did a whole podcast, I think from your referral about Blueprints and what does Blueprints is, which is a certification program. Tell us a little bit about that and if that's the only way for people to choose programs.
No, there are a variety of databases, but we have come to really appreciate Blueprints as a warehouse of a registry is another word that people use of various strategies, because we really trust their process for appraising what is coming through their door and being submitted for grading, right? For some type of rating. But Blueprints, I'm sorry, what was the question?
Oh yeah. Just tell what they are and do all programs that you support have to have that.
So all programs, a lot of people are
it's like a stamp of approval, right? It's a graded stamp of approval for a program.
It's the first step. So when we think about evidence, we think about research evidence, and that's what you're going to get from blueprints. But then you also have to think about contextual evidence and experiential evidence. There are three prongs that you think through. But blueprints is fantastic at giving you the on a continuum of from potentially harmful, right, to best practice or what they call model plus. They'll tell you where a certain program practice falls on this continuum based on the evidence that's been submitted to them. And that's the value of blueprints. You can feel certain, right, that it has been looked at by researchers, it has been appraised based on a continuum of evidence, and it has been given there's a consistency and a systematic approach to appraising that. So you can feel confident in that rating. But they also are very transparent when you do a keyword search for substance use prevention. They'll show you all the programs, and they're very transparent in a description of the program, the studies that were reviewed, right, and some of these conclusions related to it. They'll also speak to, when they can, a cost-benefit analysis of sorts and give you some idea of cost related to it. So they are very transparent, concrete, upfront with what they are presenting. And that's what you can rely on. That's the benefit of having these registries. But if you're a coalition or a community-based partner or a healthcare setting, anyone, and you just want to go out and also determine, you know, what else is out there, right? You can do that. You can do that. But it's not what we would recommend today. We'd recommend that you start at these warehouses. You know, these registries, they have been built for a reason, because it's a nice consolidated place to determine what has already been studied, what do we know works or does not work, because there is the other end of the continuum that you also want to be very mindful of, right? And then you determine, once you've looked at the evidence base and extracted a few from that, you determine, you know, what is going to be the best fit based on my context and my experience.
Right. That's great. And are programs in general that you're recommending drug specific? We talked about fentanyl education versus upstream and resiliency kind of training, or both?
The majority of substance use prevention programs that have demonstrated effectiveness towards preventing onset of use, escalation of use, or reducing use, those core components are going to usually hover around healthy decision making, drug refusal skills, right? Trusted adult relationships, these pro-social activities and opportunities for those. So we have a list of components that we know usually are present in the majority of programs that have been demonstrated to work for substance use prevention. So, and they very much are related to giving youth the skills, honoring their sense of agency and tapping into that, right? And these relational elements that I was talking about earlier. So parenting is one of the number one strategies.
Yes. The family, the family. That's awesome.
Yeah.
True. Yeah, that's great. So if, Laura, if I gave you a magic wand and I said, I want you to tell me what it takes to increase this type of, be specific, primary prevention, in not starting drugs, you know, going way upstream. What policies would you want to see? What would your recommendations be?
Here's how I would answer that. I would go even further upstream. If you were to ask me what type of mindset is needed to make a difference across the board, no matter what role you're in, if you're a politician, if you're an attorney general, if you're a district attorney, an educator, a superintendent, right? A chief of police, whatever it is. The mindset is this. It's something that I call a responsibility, opportunity, investment mindset, ROI for prevention. Responsibility is a huge word that people don't pay enough attention to. And if you were to ask yourself, in my role, what can I be responsible for? And that's key. What can I be responsible for? And all of us are responsible for understanding the evidence. All of us are responsible for understanding what works in everything that we do. There is not one role that should not be aware of the science we have today, that prevention science, because that science is looking at what determines all of these things we are investing money in, right? To help prevent, right? Think about the opioid crisis, an epidemic, right? We have so much money going towards that, but all of us have a responsibility. And I don't know that we sit with that long enough. And frequently, and I say this very sincerely, in technical assistance requests, frequently, I might be reminded of a conversation I had with the director of a prevention program. And if I've learned something new about, hey, or if I have a thought about, hey, you know, they really could tweak that program to be more effective in this way, I feel a responsibility to call them and to just share that with them, to have a conversation around what would it look like if you were to advance the program in this way. So responsibility is something that is relative and means something different to everyone. But in this case, if we all just looked at our individual responsibilities related to the evidence, we could really make a dent in this. O for opportunities, right? As a policymaker, if you are engaging your sense of responsibility, then the opportunities they abound, right? So, but being also very thoughtful around, it's not just your professional opportunities. Where are the opportunities in your lives to also carry that evidence that you're responsible for, carry it forward in your own home, right? In your own community, right? So it really is a systems way of thinking about opportunities that will help advance us with this magic wand you've asked me to talk about. And then finally, investment. At the end of the day, we all have to ask ourselves, how much am I willing to invest in this effort in bringing that evidence forward in my professional life and my personal life? And it really does come to that. If you think about something as simple, Ronit, as this, you're riding in the car, driving your kids to a sports practice. Am I willing to invest that time in engaging them about their school day, in talking with them, in developing the relationship further, right? That's an investment right then and there in that 10-minute drive, right? Or on a much higher level, as a policymaker, am I willing to go out and actively seek additional knowledge and understanding, gather the information I need to put together and package the most impactful policy that I can, right? That's an investment. It takes more than just gathering one focus group, right? It might take review of several materials or bringing together the right experts to help facilitate that understanding. But it all comes full circle and it all relates to each other. But it starts with us. Starts with us and us owning and really honoring and respecting the sense of responsibility that we all have to make a dent and also just to prepare to create that future of well-being for our youth that you were speaking about earlier.
So if there are communities out there who are interested in increasing prevention programs in their community, what is your advice? Where do they go?
Everywhere. So In more communities than not, there usually is a coalition.
I usually just refer them to you, Laura. I just say, go to ADAPT.
Right. Well, we're always available and we're always here, but we are one entity, right? And so we would always encourage coalitions have 12 sector representation. They usually are plugged in, right, to some type of greater source. And so they're a great starting point for also what's happening already in that community. Because you want to understand what's already going on before you try to start doing more, right? So yes, at the community level, we always recommend starting with the coalition and those community-based partners that seem to already be doing the work, right? But then at the national level, we've got ADAPT as the Training and Technical Assistance Division. We're always happy to have a conversation with folks. And we offer our own tiered approach to TA. We've got several public offerings and services that we offer across the nation. Would love for anyone to participate and tap into that by going to our website. Can I put a plug in?
Yes, that's what it's for.
Yeah, so HIDTA.org, HIDTA.org/ADAPT.
And I'll have this on, I have a link to this on the show notes.
Yeah. So that's where you can go and learn about ADAPT and sign up for any future events or trainings that we might be offering. But yeah, we like to walk alongside communities and support in any way that makes sense for them, while also kind of honoring these truths for prevention, right? And the evidence, and trying to maintain, right, these boundaries with, we could go a lot of different directions, but here's the best available evidence, and here's how you can build your own evidence base.
Yes, prevention science. I think that is the path to a healthier America for substance disorder and any other disease, medical or mental. And thank you so much, Laura, that you've helped us in San Diego. I referred the folks from Boston, Massachusetts. You'll be hearing from them because they wanted to do a program. And like, wait, no, before you just kind of shop for programs, go to you, work with the HIDAs, work with you. I think you do a great job. There's a lot of resources there. And really, I think every community in America needs to have this.
Thank you so much for inviting us and letting us share the word. We always call ourselves small but mighty. And so we definitely want to hold the hands of any community that would like to advance with the prevention work that they're doing, right? And just need a little additional support.
Thank you for listening to High Truths on Drugs and Addiction, where you learn from experts from around the globe and around all aspects of drugs. This week's episode would not be possible without the generous support of our sponsor. A sincere and warm thank you to Drug Free America Foundation. Visit dfaf.org. And ISAC, the International Academy on the Science and Impact of Cannabis. That's IASIC1.org. High Truth's producer is Dave Rivas from Davey Boy Productions. I'm your host, Dr. Onit Lev. We hope we brought your day a little bit more High Truths. Thank you.